This is The Urban Connection, the weekly show on issues that affect the community.
2020 has been a difficult and traumatic year in America. Today, we're honored to be joined by the president of the New York Urban League to talk about racism, policing, and where we go from here as a country.
In this particular situation, all you hear is silence, a man pleading that he can't breathe, and then calling for his mother. Collectively, African-American women's hearts were broken when they heard him calling for his mother that way. But I honestly believe that this time, it hit white women's hearts as well.
I'm Leonard Birdsong. The Urban Connection starts right after this.
Now, The Urban Connection continues. Once again, here's Leonard Birdsong.
Hello, folks. This is Leonard Birdsong back on The Urban Connection. Glad that you can be with us. Just as the country begins to recover from the coronavirus, the growing protests in the streets show that it's not just the only disease, but there has been a disease that's plagued America since its inception, racism. Our guest today is Arva Rice. She is the CEO and president of the New York Urban League. She is a passionate community leader, and she's dedicated herself to creating pathways to success for young people with focus on girls and women. She graduated from Northwestern University. Arva, thank you for coming on the Urban Connection today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, you know, we're going through some trying times. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about the New York Urban League?
Absolutely. So the New York Urban League is one of 90 Urban League affiliates throughout the country, dedicated to empowering communities and changing lives in education, employment, housing, and healthcare. And the New York Urban League focuses specifically in the areas of education, employment, and advocacy. And as you know, but I'll just refresh for your viewers and listeners, that the Urban Leagues were started during the Great Migration, where folks were in the South and they were suffering from horrible atrocities that were happening to African Americans who were, you know, working, picking cotton and picking tobacco, and just really living under terrible housing conditions, really bad access to housing and education, and wanted to make the decision to build better lives for themselves and their families. And so they made that great trek to the North and landed in places like Chicago and Philadelphia and New York. Many of them even got to Los Angeles. And when they got there, they needed supports and services, and Urban Leagues were created at that time. And we've been serving our communities for over 100 years.
Well, that's wonderful. That's just wonderful. It's a great civil rights organization, but you also have some things to say about what's going on in the country with the protesters and you know, the killing of George Floyd. What do we have to do to keep things going in the right direction? I think they're started to go in the right direction. There has to be some change in laws and in policing and criminal justice in the United States. Mm-hmm. You say that why you want to talk about why black people still can't wait. Mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
Yes. So I wrote an essay called Why Black People Still Can't Wait, which, as you know, is a takeoff of Martin Luther King's article that he wrote from the Birmingham jail, explaining to some of the other members of the Baptist convention that he was a part of, as well as to others, why it was that African Americans were at a point in a place where we were demanding justice. And so that moment is exacerbated right now. I've had people ask me the question, why this particular moment? Why are white people suddenly waking up to racism? Why are our young people angry and in the streets? Why are we having this demand? And I think that, as you mentioned in the opening, that we are looking right now at America's original disease, but it was COVID-19 that helped to create this moment. What other moment in time were people basically sent home? Even if you were an essential worker, at the end of the day, you're not allowed to go to a movie theater. You're not allowed to go to your church, your mosque, or your synagogue. You're not allowed to really connect with other people. So it's this moment we were in some senses, we were all home. Yep. And so we were all looking at the same moment, all looking at that 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And so as a result of that, it was harder to deny. as a result of that, it was harder to just ignore. And so as a result of that, people took to the streets. The second piece that makes this moment in time different is that we had legislators in place who could make the sweeping change. Mm-hmm. So on the Senate side, you had Senate Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins. On the Assembly side, you had Carl Hastings, and we had our governor, who were all in place. People literally took out legislation that they had written 4, 5, 7 years ago, pulled it out, dusted it off, and said, look, we finally got the majority. We've got the political will. Let's get this done. So it is in some ways, obviously, a really tough and terrible time. But in other ways, this perfect storm can be used for catapulting some amazing change. And that's what's happening right now.
Yeah, and I think it is happening. And I have to agree with you that maybe, well, look, I used to be a federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C. I know about police and I've worked with them and I know what kinds of things go on. There have been a lot of shootings of unarmed black men in the United States, and it never seemed to register that much with the white community. And I think you're saying, and I believe, that people staying home watching TV about poor George Floyd and this police officer with his knee on his neck did waken a lot of white folks, okay? Isn't that true?
No, absolutely. And, you know, even if a person is running away, even if the person did back talk, even if a person did all these things that are always used as a rebuttal, yep. In this particular situation, all you hear is silence, a man pleading that he can't breathe, and then calling for his mother.
Mother, that's right. That's exactly
right. We know that collectively African-American women's hearts were broken when they heard him calling for his mother that way. But I honestly believe that this time, it hit white women's hearts as well.
Mm-hmm. What do you think needs to be done for police departments around the country?
Well, I do want to applaud our elected officials, particularly in New York, who have taken incredible strides over the course of the last 2 weeks. The package of legislation that Governor Cuomo refers to as, you know, say their name, is remarkable. The repeal of 50A, which no longer seals police's records of any misdeeds that they've had in the past. The chokehold legislation that was championed by Senator Brian Benjamin is legislation that we've been looking at ever since Eric Garner obviously lost his life. The legislation that's been put in place around dash cams and the use of cameras, body cameras, is wonderful. Policies and procedures that Mayor de Blasio has put forward as well. And so the legislation that's been put into place is fantastic. It's very good. But obviously there's going to be more work that needs to be done, both at the federal level, because the House and the Senate are still battling back and forth on what that federal legislation is going to look like.
Yep.
It's important for people to know that localities are important, but we don't want to have a bad officer be able to move from Wisconsin and then go to, you know, Minnesota and be able to participate in that same terrible behavior. And so some of the federal legislation is designed to keep that from happening, putting together things like a federal registry, and some other pieces. And so there's still more work to be done. The other piece that Governor Cuomo most recently asked for is a reimagining of the police departments. And that has to be done by April of 2021 in order for them to keep their state funding in place. Mm-hmm. That is terrific. We think it's a great step, but it wasn't given with any specific guidelines. And mm-hmm. so we, as nonprofit organizations, as people who are advocates in this space, want to be able to provide and bring together best practices from other states in order that we can bring those to bear and community advocates can really push for positive change. It's wonderful that people are marching in the streets. It has been part of this movement towards the idea and notion that change is necessary, but marching in the streets doesn't give you the information in order to give a police department instruction on how they can better police, right? So we want to make sure that we call on those folks who have been gathered in this fight and be able to bring their best practices to bear.
We're talking with Arva Rice, president and CEO of the New York Urban League, and we're discussing the relationship between the African-American community and police. We'll have more in a moment here on The Urban Connection.
More of The Urban Connection straight ahead. Stay tuned. Let's return to the Urban Connection. Once again, here's Leonard Birdsong.
Welcome back. Our guest is Arva Rice, president and CEO of the New York Urban League. Arva, there are many white police officers who don't see us as people, and they have license to kill us. That's wrong. Mm. And now we have Mr. Brooks, who was shot in the back for running away from the police because he had a taser with him that he had taken from one of the police officers. Why would they just have to shoot this fellow? He was two blocks from his sister's house. He even said, you know, he was stopped not for any kind of felony crime. He had supposedly fallen asleep in his car because he had a couple of drinks. And he wasn't doing anything. It's not a crime to do that. He even asked the police, why can you just take me over to my sister's house? It's only two blocks away. And they decided they wanted to handcuff him. What is going, I mean, I guess maybe it's just a culture that in the blue culture that you must make black people bend or bow to their authority. I guess that's what it is. And I guess that's deeply ingrained. Right. And that's a shame. It's horrible.
Well, there's a number of things that you talked about in that in your brilliant analysis of what's going on, and I just wanted to hone in on two of them. Okay. And I think that's and I think that the first one is like what is exactly what you said about you know, a grouping of people who has a certain opinion of black people, opinion of inferiority, and are able to act through those that predisposition of who African-Americans are, and unfortunately they have guns. And so for many years, we have been told that there is a set of bad apples. And so most police officers are good. And the fact is that there are police officers that are good. There are police officers that are members of, you know, everyone's families or extended families. People know good police officers. However, if we were to be talking about pilots, it would not be acceptable to have a group of pilots who regularly crash planes.
Yeah, right.
We would not say that it's okay to have just a group of bad apples. If we were talking about chefs, it would not be okay to have a group of chefs who regularly killed their patrons because their food is so terrible. But they're just a few bad apples. So why is it that we as African Americans are constantly told that it's okay to have a few bad apples who kill us? And so I think that that is the moment and the place and time that we are. I have been part of various police advisory boards and had the opportunity to interact with police officers and talk about their training and talk about their diversity training. And I had an officer, you know, look me in the face and say, you know, Miss Rice, you need to understand that we see people at the very worst points in time. We see them when they're, you know, arguing and about to stab each other over Thanksgiving dinner. Right. You know, we see them when somebody's just, you know, beaten another member of their family, when, you know, somebody's just shot a gun. And I said, yes, but you see white people in those situations too, right? So how is it that we're the ones who always end up dead? So I think that part of the legislation needs to be about additional training for officers. And they have a tendency to focus the training on rookies, so people coming into the force. But the fact is that the behaviors are either sanctioned or they're chastised by those individuals who have been in the force for a long time. And so the training needs to be going throughout, and it needs to be ongoing. Not one time you come in and then you're on the force for 25 years and there's no ongoing sort of training or checks and balances. And then I also think that the various legislation that we put into place will help as well, because the fact is, and also going back to the George Floyd killing, that the fact that there's an individual who could be looking into the cam and know that there's a tape, videotape that's being shown, and continue to engage in the behavior that they honestly think there is no consequence. There's no consequence for taking a black life. Right. And so that's why people are marching, is because there has to be a consequence to taking a black life in order to change behavior.
Now, my program is aimed at African-Americans who very often don't hear these kinds of things on radio. So what can you tell the listeners as to what you want to tell white folks?
This has been an interesting thought and question as well. And I will look at that from two different perspectives as well. I grew up in a very integrated environment in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I have a number of people on my Facebook page who have suddenly become not my friends over the course of the last few years because they insisted that all lives mattered. And so I have one story about a woman whose Facebook I rarely see. I wanted to defriend her, but I said, let me just go ahead and keep it on there. And she had written quite a manifesto about how this moment in time had changed her mind, and that she really truly believed that Black Lives Mattered, and talked a little bit about why and how she came to that realization. On balance, I looked at the description of another person, actually an older adult in my life, and my brother had brought my attention to it because he was so upset about it. And she had posted the article from Ben Carson, where Ben Carson talks about how we need to grow up and we need to get over some of the things that have happened in the past. And she had posted it and had written the comment, amen, next to it. And so just having to interact with some folks who clearly are still not woke. So that's one end. And I think that, you know, as I put my response to her and tagged every member of my family and every member of that school that had been a part of it, you know, we all kind of went to kind of set the record straight about how this moment in time is about George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. But it's also about Emmett Till and Sean Bell, and it's about Amadou Diallo, and it's about the 400 years that our people have been oppressed in this country. And so that's one set of experiences. The other experience I have is obviously as the head of the New York Urban League, I'm interacting with African-American, our participants in our programs, our young professionals who volunteer with our services, our board of directors, our funders. And so we had a leadership meeting a couple of weeks ago. And we're just giving an opportunity and a space and place for people to just share their frustration, their anger, their hope, their sense of hopelessness. And so we had that conversation and then just we're talking about what's next. What is the place and space that the Urban League should be working? And one of the young people on the call was saying that, you know, she's getting on her Skype call. Her office is still not open, but she's getting on her Skype calls. And, you know, the white people at work are calling her, they're texting her, they're, you know, sending her notes, you know, trying to see if she's okay. And if that there's anything that she can do. Mm-hmm. And it's exhausting for her. You know, mm-hmm. It's exhausting for her trying to be the person in the office to explain to them, you know, what, you know, let me explain to you what you have been trained and culturally told and experienced, because let's be clear, white folks are told that talking about race is taboo, that it's impolite. So by the time they're 10 years old, if they live in any somewhat of a progressive household, they're told that, you know, they're colorblind. Well, if you're colorblind, not only do you not see us, but you don't see racism and you don't see discrimination. Mm-hmm. And so putting it on an individual, you know, the African-American in whatever their corporate setting, business setting, work setting, to try to explain what white people have been told is impolite to talk about for the majority of their lives is a challenge. And so we're working on, you know, just developing conversations and toolkits and guides for how to have those conversations, because it is triggering, it is upsetting, and it's frustrating. But I think that this is the time and the moment that we need to have them. And we're doing that in some structured ways. We're working with a couple of corporations in order to introduce to them, as you know, the New York Urban League, the National Urban League produces the State of Black America every year, mm-hmm, which is about kind of where African Americans are in key areas, education, employment, housing, healthcare, civic engagement, and criminal justice. And so the New York Urban League will produce our State of Black New York, and we'll release it in July. And so we're using that as a springboard to say, here's a set of data that talks about the difference that it makes because you all had us in slavery. And we never got our 40 acres and a mule. So here are the facts. Here are the statistics. We're going to talk about it. And then we're going to talk about what that means and what are the strategies going forward.
All right. This is very good. I was talking with my wife, you know, today, as a matter of fact, about how do you, as a white police officer, shoot anyone in the back that's running for their life when they think probably that I haven't really done anything wrong. Mm-hmm. What would you do if that was your son or your brother or your mother or something like that? Can't you have some kind of compassion? I mean, they had the guy's driver's license and they had all information. They could have let the guy run off and then the next day go to his house and arrest him for fleeing. I don't, you know, it didn't happen like that. But it's just something in the psyche that is wrong. And I don't know if we're going to be able to change it, but I certainly hope so. I really do. Mm-hmm. But I agree with what you say, but let me just lighten the thing, the load a little bit here. I'm talking about some heavy stuff. Did you ever have the privilege of meeting is it Whitney Young, who was once president of the Urban League, National Urban League?
No. Yes, the legendary Whitney M. Young had passed.
Yes.
Well before my time at the New York Urban League. I have had the great opportunity to interact with all of the current living presidents, Vernon Jordan and John Jacobs and Hugh Price, but I never had an opportunity to interact with Whitney M. Young.
Well, I never met him myself, but I was a Foreign Service officer for a part of my career, and I was stationed in Nigeria twice. And one of my postings, I was the director of the Whitney Young American Library in Lagos, Nigeria.
So, oh, look at that.
Isn't that something? Isn't it a small world?
It is a small, small world. Absolutely. Absolutely. But, I'm sure so many of your listeners are already steeped in African-American history. But to underscore, because he came up, Whitney M. Young is just so important to the Urban League movement and to the cause for civil rights. And he truly was a power broker and was able to utilize the role and the access that he had in order to really push for creating legislation and policy that has changed the lives of African Americans. So very, very proud to work in his movement.
Right. You also mentioned Emmett Till. I guess many younger African Americans don't know the story, or maybe they do because their families know about it. I was a young kid when that happened, and it was gruesome. But his mother wanted to have the open casket to show what people can do to others. It's just demonic. Remember that? You were probably too young. I'm not sure if you were born when that happened. But.
I was not born when it happened, but I often talk about people's moments. And for my mom, that was her moment. So Emmett Till was her moment to really recognize just how horrible people can be. And so for every generation, we have to have our moment when we realize that freedom is won in every generation, as Coretta Scott King said, and that this movement is not over until we continue to fight for justice and there is true equality. For me, it was the Rodney King riots. Very moving moments for me that I was very well aware of racial injustice growing up. My parents were originally from the South. They were sharecroppers and moved to Milwaukee to make a better life for their kids. So I was certainly aware of it. But when the Rodney King riots happened, that's when I became devoted to what is the part of the movement that I'm going to be activated around. And then in working with the Urban League, it was, you know, the Eric Garner trial and verdict for our young professionals was devastating. And so for them, it made them have to either become bitter and step out or rededicate themselves to this work. And so many of them thankfully have recommitted to making sure that we continue to empower communities and change lives.
All right. Well, Arva, it's been great talking to you. I'm running out of time. I wish I had more time, but do you have some final words of wisdom for our African-American listeners about keeping the faith and knowing that change is going to come?
No, absolutely. I want people to realize that it took this incredible moment of COVID-19 to get America to look at its original disease of racism. But we are here now. We have legislators in place. If there was ever a time and a place to recognize the power of the vote, it is right now. If we did not have the legislators in place, we could not have passed the set of legislation that people have been fighting for decades. Please fill out the census. It's how we're counted. And so we want to make sure that people do that. Get out and vote in November. Don't just vote yourselves, but bring 9 people with you. Send 9 texts, make 9 phone calls. But you got to get out there and vote. And together, it's a long road, but, you know, change will come.
It will come. You're absolutely right. Thank you so much for coming on, Arva. I wish I had more time for you, but you keep up the good work you're doing, okay?
Thank you so much.
We've been listening to Arva Rice, CEO and president of the New York Urban League, and she's given us some hope for the future. And that's all the time we have this week. I'm Leonard Birdsong, inviting you to join us again next time for more of The Urban Connection.
That wraps up this episode of The Urban Connection with your host, Leonard Birdsong, a production of Syndication Networks of Chicago. Thanks for listening, and join us next time for another edition of The Urban Connection.